switch! Wrong the third switch!
Not the third switch.
Run, I say! Run!
The Guy James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Fly! Fly, you hear me? Give my creation! Fly!
So this was fun.
You're going to like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Good countdown. 6. 5. 4. 3, 2, 1.
You have entered a restricted broadcast area. You have entered a restricted broadcast.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Welcome, everybody. Glad to have you along with us today, back in the home studio. Back from the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., and the Take Back America Conference. For the Campaign for America's Future, what a pleasure it was to travel there this time. As you all know, I always enjoy going to Washington, always come back and talk about it a little bit. Maybe I shouldn't, but I do enjoy the nation's capital very, very much. It's always an interesting experience every time I go, learn something new, see something new, whatever. Although this time, stayed pretty much in the area. We were in the Adams Morgan area up Connecticut Avenue there, close to Rock Creek Park. You all know what that's famous for. It was right out back of the hotel, the Omnisorm. Interesting place, and really a wonderful area of Washington, D.C., and I want to thank everybody involved with the Campaign for America's Future for inviting us. It was an exceptional campaign this year, an exceptional conference. Always come back energized from these, have the batteries recharged, always learn a whole lot. Do want to say a special thank you to our, one of the good guys of the Hit On Radio Network. Mark Levine was there, and we were side by side at our Radio Row table, and it was great to see Mark again. We got to share a pair of several private jokes, and some we will probably tell you about. But Mark was there working very, very hard and getting some great interviews as well, doing a little taping for his TV program. Our good broadcasting friends, Warren Ballantyne and Peter B. Collins and John Elliott and Lionel and of course, Mark. And Ed Schultz was there. Yes, Ed Schultz. You want to hear a good Ed Schultz story? As you all know, I love telling Ed Schultz stories. Of course, Ed doesn't speak to me, you know. So, checking into the hotel Sunday, and Eddie's standing there with his nose up in the air, doesn't speak to anybody. He's the king, you know. He hates it when I say that. He hates it when any of us say that. Anyway, being the good old Ed that he is. And so, had dinner Sunday evening, and I got a little story about that, too. But anyway, we had dinner Sunday evening down in the Omni dining room. And we were enjoying ourselves, having a nice conversation, and Schultz walks up. And he says to the organizer of the whole thing, I want to see where this Radio Row is going to be tomorrow morning. Of course, he says it in a different style than that. He says it in Rush Limbaugh style because he sounds just like Rush. Yes, he walked up to him and said, I want to see where Radio Row is going to be tomorrow. I need to know before I go to bed tonight. So everybody goes downstairs to the hall where we're going to have Radio Row. And, of course, LaVisa, the gal in charge of it, was still busy with the whole crew setting everything up, the curtains and the tables and the microphones and the cables. And it's a big undertaking to set the whole thing up. It really is. It's a huge undertaking. And little LaVisa Frost that takes care of planning these things, the logistics of them. She's amazing. She's just amazing. She was there till at least 3 o'clock in the morning, and keep in mind, some of these broadcasters start at 6. So she was there getting all this ready, and so we all go downstairs, and I think Mark Ballantyne was there, and I know Peter B. was there, maybe John Elliott was there, and Schultz is down there as well. And Schultz looks around at where they were going to have him, and he says, "Oh no, that won't do. I cannot be in that spot right there because I'm loud, and I'll drown everybody out." Yeah. And so, the next day, we all go down to Radio Row when it's time to do our shows. And Schultz, I don't know what time his show's on. Noon, something, I'm not sure. He was doing his show, and we were all to do the shows on Monday and Tuesday. Well, Schultz did his show on Monday, and as he had predicted, he was loud, and he certainly was annoying other people. And didn't show on Tuesday. And we found out why he didn't show on Tuesday is because he told the organizers of this event that it's just too noisy for me. There's too much confusion. I cannot do a professional radio show from such chaos and around such noise. He's the one that was making the noise. So thought I'd let you in on that little radio scuttlebutt that takes place at these things, but always enjoyable to work with Ed Schultz. I'm going to have a lot of audio on the program today, and the reason I'm going to do that is I was fortunate enough to get to go to the gala event Tuesday night after the whole thing was over with. I didn't know I was going to get to attend that, and so we got to go and rub elbows with all the big shots and fat cats and all that of Washington, everybody who is anybody on the liberal progressive side of the coin, was there. A great big dinner. And, of course, the guest of honor, the main honoree for the evening, was, of course, Norman Lear for his Lifetime Achievement Award. We'll bring you some of his words. And Illinois Representative Jan Schakowsky was there. She was honored for her activism. And, of course, Van Jones and Majora Carter, a lot of you know who they are. They were honored for the great activist jobs they've been doing in the greening of America area. And, of course, Donna Edwards was there. And you all know about Donna Edwards. What a great gal Donna Edwards is. She's over there in the, I believe it's the 4th District, Congressional District in Maryland. I'm pretty sure it's the 4th. As you well know, many of you, she beat an incumbent Democrat. His name's getting away. Wynn's his name. And he was in for several terms, and she beat him. Ran against him in the primary and beat him. He's a Democrat. And why did she run against him? Because he was one of these people that we need to make sit up and pay attention to us for a change. This conference this year was more about us and less about, the leading contenders for the presidency and all that. It was more about our issues as liberals, as Democrats, and that's what really was paid attention to this year. And Robert Borisaj, who's ahead of the whole thing, him and Roger Hinckley, they were extremely pleased with the turnout this year because without having a headliner like an Obama or Hillary Clinton there, we still had a huge turnout and a lot of great guests. But I was talking about Donna Edwards. She ran against an incumbent Democrat and she beat him, a guy who had not listened to the constituency and was voting instead along with Junior Bush on a lot of issues. The local Democrats didn't like it. Donna ran against him and beat him. And, of course, when he found out Donna was going to run against him, you see, he had run against her once and narrowly beat her. And when he found out she was going to run again, why, he changed his tune about the war and all. But it was far too little, and it was far too late. So, very, very interesting. And the guest I had, I want to thank the organizers for setting us up. And I know Mark feels the same way with such a great guest this year. Kathleen Kennedy Townsend. Just an outstanding individual. Just loved her. Elizabeth Bagley, who was the former ambassador to Portugal, and she's the one of the in the Treasury Department of Hillary's campaign, the Finance Committee on her campaign. Brother of Howard Dean, Jim Dean for DFA. Anton Gunn. If you heard the interview with Anton Gunn, you know. My thoughts about him, an absolutely outstanding young man, a former football player for the University of South Carolina. Big guy, running for the House of Representatives for the state of South Carolina, the state house there. And I certainly hope he gets it. I do expect that you will hear him running for United States Congress or United States Senate some of these days, because he's a man that... I don't think can be stopped should he end up with the right financing. I don't think he can be stopped. He's too intelligent. He's too well-spoken. He's just a terrific individual. And I know some of you are probably tired of me talking about him, but I could not get over what an outstanding individual he is. Anton Gunn, do remember that name. And, of course, Robert Boris Hodge and Roger Hinckley, ahead of the whole thing, had some nice conversations with Robert Greenwald and Vice Chair of the DNC, Susie Turnbull, and got a chance to talk to Phil Donahue for quite a little while. I think Mark may have interviewed him. I'm pretty sure he did, and got some of that tape. And had dinner with Jesse Jackson Sunday night. Yes, indeed, had dinner with Jesse Jackson Sunday night. That was quite interesting. Man, completely different than the persona he puts forth on TV. I really, really enjoyed talking to Jesse Jackson. And dining with that little group we had there. And met some great Horn listeners. Yes, there were quite a few Horn listeners there at the conference. And I want to say hello to all them. And it was a pleasure meeting you. Pleasure sitting and talking with you and hearing your views and sharing. And it was a great time. So thank you to the listeners of the Horn that were there at the Take Back America conference. Love getting together with you. I really think that being at this great conference this year, that there is something really special happening in America right now. I really do. We're making history, and it is my contention, and you know I've said this for a while now, it's my contention that we will win the White House easily. And a lot of people, oh, no, don't say that. Well, I do believe that. I do believe that once the campaigns quit the little infighting deal we got going on in the primary right now, and it is not a big deal. It really isn't, not to me. I think we'll get together. We'll coalesce. We'll have one candidate, and we will easily win the White House. And what we need to concentrate on also is gaining lots of seats in the House. I think we will. I think we'll gain a few seats in the Senate. I don't know if we'll get quite over the hump that we need to get that 60 majority, but we may get close to it. And that is, and I want to take special note of that, that is barring any unforeseen, horribly devious tactics by the Republicans. And you may think you know what I'm talking about, because we had the Swift Boat thing the last time. You know how that went. We had the Supreme Court the time before. And those were indeed dirty, rotten, no good, unethical, immoral outcomes. The tactics of the neocons for those, both as low as you can go. But I had several long conversations, and one in particular with someone that you all know of very, very well, a very astute politico. And so it was an off-the-record conversation, so I will not mention his or her name. I have to some people privately, but I will not mention his or her name. But let it suffice to say that it is someone very, very well connected, very well known in Washington. And this person says that many of the leaders in the Democratic Party are seriously afraid of something big, big happening between now and the election. And I mean something big. They are afraid, the Republicans, the neocons in particular, will do something absolutely awful. Something unthinkable to most people. In order to use the United States citizens' fear, once again, to win an election. And I'm not going to go on about it, but just, again, let it suffice to say that this is a general fear of many of the progressive, liberal, democratic leaders in Washington, that they are afraid something horrible will happen, and it won't be an accident. Many of our leaders are living in fear that the neocons will actually do something awful and something crazy to keep their power. In fact, really and truly, I had this conversation with three different liberal progressive leaders, and it does frighten me. And I'm not one prone to listening to rumor. I'm not one to listening to wild conjecture. As you know, I'm just not like that. But it's something that we have to be very, very well aware of. And something that we shouldn't be surprised if something terrible happens. And once again, they will use anything and everything at their disposal, no matter what. Because the neocons, the theocons, want their way. And they were well on to having their way. Until Bill Clinton put a stop to them for 8 years. And as you know, they did anything and everything to win the last two elections, by hook or by crook. And they will do it again, no matter what it takes. And while having these discussions, the word anything, I must tell you, came up a lot. And anything is a big word. So, don't be surprised. Don't be surprised if the fear-mongering stops. You remember the last time we had the threat levels raised time and time and time again before the election, and really we haven't had much of it since, have we? But they used fear, and they think nothing of using fear to frighten the American people into doing whatever they want them to do out of fear. It's been used over and over again, and it'll happen again. Of course, one of the other things I want to talk about today is the Obama speech. I've heard much about it. I've heard much from you about it. I've heard much from many, many people. I am surprised at some of the things I hear. Let me just give you an example of a couple of emails that are sitting right in front of me, considering my comments about the presidential campaign. One of them says, "Guy, don't you think you've kissed Hillary's feet enough on your show? Give me a break and be fair for a change. The bitch isn't worthy of being our nominee, but you've backed her 100% of the time. Why?" That's from Gerald. Just three or four emails down from that one, "Guy, how about getting off the Obama kick for a while? He may be a great guy and very smart, but he isn't ready to be president. But you keep saying that he's the greatest thing sliced bread. Maybe for a change you could say something nice about Hillary." So, we're getting it from all sides. Let me say again, I love both of these people. I do. For different reasons. I am thrilled. Thrilled. that we're going to have a woman or a black man as the president of the United States. I cannot tell you how happy that makes me, that one or the other. And I know some of you, you Obama people, are going, no, I don't want you to be happy if Hillary gets. And some of the Obama people, no, you know, I'm back and forth. I know. And I know there's strong feelings about it. But I have to tell you, I don't have, and maybe I should, but I don't have really strong feelings about one or the other coming out the winner. Because I swear to you, whichever one gets it, I can just get in line and follow them no problem whatsoever. And I know there are some fundamental differences between them, and I know some of them both of them have done something that the other side doesn't like along the way. Both of them have done some votes that I don't like along the way, but I do recognize the fact that nobody's going to be perfect. So, cool your jets, people. I promise you, either one of these people is going to be worthy of being the President of the United States. And I say for the 972nd time, lest you doubt that you should be for one or the other and join in if your candidate loses, look across the fence. Do always look across the fence and see the awful monster that's over there. And I don't mean John McCain in particular is an awful monster. He may be a decent guy. But look at the neocons that are over there salivating on the other side of the fence, wanting to keep on taking away your money, wanting to keep on giving tax cuts to the rich, wanting to keep on shifting the wealth from the rich, from us to the rich, so that we end up as slaves. Remember that. They want you to have enough to eat so that you can subsist. They want you to have some clothing and a roof over your head sometime, and they want you to barely be able to afford gasoline so you can get to work and work for them. And that's all they want you to have. And I'm not crazy in saying something like that. That is exactly what they want. That is exactly what they've been working for. That is the tact they have taken. And you can see it happening right before your eyes. You have seen in the last decade and a half or so a massive shift in wealth in this country. Massive. You have seen the pay of the CEOs go totally out of proportion with all reason. You have seen the benefits of the working people go literally down the toilet. You have seen the insurance benefits disappear. You have seen pensions disappear. Employee benefits of all kind disappear. Mark my word, if these people are allowed to continue the path that they've been on, the path that they are hell-bent upon staying on, you will end up being the next thing to a slave. You will be the serfs, and they will be in the castles. And that is not idle chatter. That is a promise. You can see it happening. It is happening every day. The working man in this country is on a downhill slide, and there seems to be no end to it. So please, please, when this primary is over, let's heal our wounds. The ones that we have gotten from the primary from each other. And let's band together. And let's work against what's on the other side of that fence. We must. We absolutely must. If there's to be anything resembling a middle class left in this country, we must win this election. We must. This is, without question, the most important election in the history of our country. This is an election, and I don't want to use that word they're using all over Washington now, a sea change. whatever the hell they mean by that. This is an election that can make the difference of the course of our country, taking when you come to a fork in the road, taking the right path or the wrong path, and there will be no turning back. One of those paths is going to lead the working man in the middle of the in middle class over the cliff and into the ocean to drown. We must take the other way. We must work for the working man and the woman and women. We must work for the union. We must work for the common people in this country to prosper once again. We have to take this country back. And that's what that conference is back. Take back America. Because we have got to take it back from the people that have it in their evil clutches right now and are not willing to give it up. And they are willing to do anything to keep it. Please, forget all this BS about the primary and, oh, the Democrats are fighting and they're destroying themselves. And forget that. The press is driving that. They're doing that to drive us apart so that John Sidney McCain can win the election. We must avoid this happening at all costs. We have two great candidates. We had several great candidates, but we're down to two. There's no use talking about what might have been. There's lots of John Edwards people. There's lots of Dennis Kucinich people. There's lots of Bill Richards people. There's lots of Chris Dodd people. There's lots of Joe Biden people. Not very many Gravel people. I did meet him over the weekend, too, and I got a story about that. But we had some great people, and we've come down to heaven too. And if there's anything that I can accomplish, anything that I can accomplish with this program over the next few months, is to bring everybody together. We'll never be 100% in agreement on everything, but we've got to bring everybody together. We have to. We just have to. I went to the gala on Tuesday night knowing that Norman Lear was going to speak, but I did not know who was going to introduce him. I don't use the word hero lightly, as you know. I've chastised people for using that word and cheapening it. But I have a handful of heroes in my life. I do. And one of the people that spoke at the dinner is without question one of my heroes. A well-spoken man, a great writer. He's been part of a great movement for a good many years, and I admire him to no end. And he introduced Norman Lear with a speech of his own on Tuesday night. And that man is Bill Moyers. And I got to meet Bill. And I'm not one of these ones that goes around, oh gosh, I got to. But I was thrilled to meet Bill Moyers and talk with him for a while. I'm going to play you Bill Moyers' speech in its entirety. You deserve to hear it. He was eloquent and thoughtful, as always. Ladies and gentlemen, Bill Moyers.
Now, to present America's Future Lifetime Leadership Award to my wonderful friend Norman Lear, I have the pleasure, a very great
pleasure.
This is
Kathleen Turner
introducing
Bill Moyers.
Another one of my heroes. An ordained Baptist minister who learned politics from Lyndon Johnson in Texas and in the White House, he turned to the brilliant journalism that we all love and admire. He has evolved to become a true moral philosopher. Please welcome Bill Moyer.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much for that generous introduction, and thank you for that welcome. I'm here only because the first, second, and third choices wouldn't be here. Hickey and Borisov called me and said, would you come introduce Norman, because our first three choices said no. I said, who was your first choice? And they said, Ann Coulter. She didn't feel she was down to the occasion, they said. Who was your second choice? Michael Savage. He has a broadcast on in the evening, and he couldn't make it. How about Bill O'Reilly? Oh, we asked him, but he couldn't make it. Coming through the lobby tonight, the O'Reilly Factor crew came up to Judith and me, and I didn't recognize them at first. Bill often sends his puppies over to our apartment in New York to ambush me. No, I'm serious about that. Bill feels about journalism the way Bush does about war, and he sends other people to fight it for him. And so he comes up and says he's with the O'Reilly Factor, but he's waiting. Judith notices. By the way, you applauded the face on the camera, but the person behind the face on the camera is my wife of 54 years, my partner, the executive editor and executive producer of everything we put on the air, Judith Davidson Moyer. She's there. And she noticed that this reporter from Fox News had on a Politico.com identification. Seriously. He was here under false pretenses. And I don't know whether that was because he was ashamed of being here or whether he was on a subversive mission. You may have seen the story. I'm not making this up. In the newspaper this morning, in the Times, that Fox News is infected with bedbugs. It's the truth. And as I saw this reporter from Fox News wearing a Politico.com ID instead of an ID from Fox News, I thought, back to the Spanish strategy when they came to the New World. They couldn't outsmart the natives, so they had to infect them. And so I'm suspicious that that reporter from Fox News wearing a false ID is spreading things here tonight. So if Ben Bradley and Sally and the others start scratching, you know Roger Ailes has made himself felt. I was glad to be here because democracy in America is a story of narrow escapes, and we may be running out of luck. We keep telling ourselves that for all its shortcomings, the system works. But now all bets are off. Under the spell of force, money, deceit, and fear, the great American experience of creating a better future together has been subjugated to individual cunning in the pursuit of wealth and power, and to the ravenous claims of empire and its stuporous distractions. Many people sense the political impotence, the mass resignation that our friend, the populist historian Lawrence Goodwin, describes as believing in the dogma of democracy on a superficial public level, but not believing it privately. We hold elections knowing that the odds are long against bringing the corporate state and its cutthroat capitalism under popular checks and balances. We put our faith in princes, hoping they will lead us toward the promised land, only to find us they have plunged us into the wilderness. For all the vigor at local levels, we seem unable to translate our personal commitments into new vistas of social possibility, and we grope for the political will to address our most intractable challenges. We know this earth we share as our common gift to be passed on in good condition to our children's children is being despoiled. Private wealth swells on speculation as public needs starve for elemental oxygen. Our Constitution is cast into the shadow by a powerful cabal of secrecy-obsessed authoritarians, the gravediggers of democracy. Terms like liberty and freedom, invoked by generations of Americans who battled to widen the founding promise of a more perfect union for the general welfare, have been perverted to create a government dedicated to the welfare of the state, the political class that runs it, and the donor class that exploits it. It isn't necessary to be a Jeremiah crying aloud to a sinful Jerusalem that the Lord is about to afflict them for their sins of idolatry. It isn't necessary to be Cassandra making a nuisance of herself as she wanders King Priam's palace grounds, wailing, "The Greeks are coming." Or Socrates, the gadfly, stinging the rump of power with jabs of truth. You need only to be a reporter with your eyes open. You need only to connect the dots. So, I report the assault on nature by coal mining that tears the tops off mountains and dumps them into rivers, sacrificing the health and lives of those in the river valleys to short-term profit. And I see a link between that process and the stock market frenzy, which scorns long-term investments, genuine savings in favor of quick turnovers and speculative bubbles, whose inevitable bursting leaves insiders with stuffed pockets and millions of small stockholders, pensioners, and employees out of work, out of luck, and out of hope. And then I see a connection between those disasters and the repeal of 60-year-old banking and securities regulation designed during the Great Depression to prevent exactly such human and economic damage. Who pushed for the removal of that firewall? The elected and appointed marionettes of Wall Street, who are well rewarded for their efforts with indispensable campaign contributions. Even honorable opponents of the practice get trapped in the web of an electoral system that effectively limits suffrage to those who can afford to raise millions in their run for office. Then I draw a line to the statistics that show real wages lagging behind prices, the compensation of corporate barons soaring to heights unequaled anywhere among the industrialized democracies, the endless pairing of federal funds devoted to public schools, infrastructure, retraining workers, and health care for children. And I see the latter swept away by which Americans of scant means but willing minds and hands could work and save their way upward. And I connect those numbers to our triumphant reactionaries' long campaign against labor unions and the living wage, and to their success in reframing the tax code so as to strip them of their progressive character, laying the burdens of Atlas on the struggling middle class awash in credit card debt, as wage earners strive to keep up with rising cost of housing, college tuitions, affordable health care, and even food. While huge inheritances go untouched, tax shelters abroad are legalized, and rates on capital gains are slashed, fueling not the wealth of the nation, but the greed of the neatly positioned and the nicely connected. Edward R. Murrow told his generation of journalists, "No one can eliminate prejudices, just recognize them." So here's my bias. Extremes of wealth and poverty cannot be reconciled with a genuinely democratic politics. And with that, I'm in good company. Plutarch proved prophetic when he said that an imbalance between rich and poor is the oldest and most fatal ailment of all republics. When the state becomes the patron of privilege to the neglect of justice, it mocks the very concept of government proclaimed in the preamble to our Constitution, mocks Lincoln's sacred and not misplaced trust in the people, and mocks the great progressive notion of government as a voluntary union for the good of all. In contrast, the philosophy popularized in the last quarter century that freedom simply means freedom to choose among competing brands of consumer goods, that taxes are an unfair theft from the pockets of the successful to reward the incompetent, and that the market will meet all human needs while government itself enshrines social Darwinism as public policy. This philosophy is as subversive as Benedict Arnold's portrayal of the revolution he had once served. Did I say revolution? The word stirs faintly in our DNA like an itch that cannot be altogether quieted. And it's true. We are the heirs of revolution. We're the spiritual descendants of radicals who believe that we, the people, we together, not just a favored few, could identify and would remedy common distempers and dilemmas and prove that people could be trusted with their destiny. Gordon Wood wrote a landmark book on that subject and called it The Radicalism of the American Revolution. Our nation discovered its greatness, he says, by creating a prosperous free society belonging to obscure people with their workaday concerns and their pecuniary pursuits of happiness. This democracy, he says, changed the lives of hitherto neglected and despised masses of common laboring people like Ruby and Henry Moyers. How could we have forgotten that in an age of monarchs, lords, and nobles, of feudal realms and ecclesiastical riches and the divine rights of rulers, this was the radical liberation of a universal aspiration. More compelling today for having been so often shanghaied and shackled that every age must battle in its own way to redeem it once again. I saw Majorca and Van appear, and I thought, our children are being cheated of their revolutionary heritage. Go to urban schools with high concentrations of poor and minority children, and you can understand what it must have meant to Native Americans to be segregated on reservations, isolated, powerless, shorn of any chance to participate in the shaping of your destiny in the larger world. In 1976, filming a series on the bicentennial of the American Revolution, and again in 1986, filming for the bicentennial of the Constitution, and steadily over the last decade, as Judith and I have made documentaries about education, kids in peril, and life in the inner city, I realized how little we teach our children the true story of America. It is almost a conspiracy that they're told so little of the Second Revolution of the 1790s, the populist revolt of the 1890s, the progressive era of reform, the powerful electoral ratification of the New Deal, and the equally powerful rejection of discrimination in the 1960s. Uninformed of the knowledge of a vibrant past, their imaginations have been disenfranchised. They do not know that the whole course of our history can be seen as a long journey of different struggles to make democracy work and America more just, of farmers who fought back, of slaves who rose up, of women who would not be denied, and unwelcome immigrants who wouldn't go home, and exploited workers who, against great odds, claim the revolution as their own and breathe new life into it. Who will tell these children that of the 26 amendments of the Constitution, one deals with the judiciary, one with prohibition, three with the presidency, and 20 with some extension of democracy. Who will tell them that they are written into the Declaration of Independence equal before the law as citizens and moral agents? And who will read them? Thomas Wolfe. I believe, said Wolfe, that we are lost in America, but I believe that we shall be found. I think the true discovery of America, he wrote, is before us. I think the true fulfillment of our spirit, of our people, of our mighty and mortal land is yet to come. I think, he said, the true discovery of our democracy is still before us. The man I'm here to introduce has lived his life by that light. He thinks we can make the crooked ways straight and the world over again. So he's busy these days plotting the second Boston Tea Party. Norman Lear has been my friend for 30 years, my soul brother since the Big Bang. His humor has opened us to the kaleidoscope of our humanity. He has inspired us to do the best of things in the worst of times. He has mounted the barricades against theocrats and autocrats. And relentlessly, he has fought to move America closer to the egalitarian values of democracy. And now he lives to rekindle the patriot dream. The patriot dream. Arlo Guthrie, remember? Arise, sweet destiny, time runs short. All of your patience has heard them retort, hear us now, for alone we can't seem to try to rekindle the patriot's dream. Can you hear the words being whispered? All along the American stream, tyrants freed, the just are imprisoned, trying to rekindle the patriot's dream. Ah, but perhaps too much is being asked of too few. You and your children with nothing to do. Hear us now, for alone we can't seem to try to rekindle the patriot's dream. Living now here, but for fortune placed by fate's mysterious schemes, who would believe that we're the ones asked to rekindle the patriot's dreams? Who would believe such a radical thing? You're about to meet him.
And, of course, he's talking about Norman Lear. And I'm going to play the audio of Norman Lear for you. I didn't think it was fair to go to that event and not present these two wonderful talks to you. As I mentioned, Bill Moyers, a hero of mine for a long time. I think he's the finest wordsmith that I know of in my life. I don't know anybody that can put things on paper or into a speech that can do a better job of at least expressing my thoughts, and many of yours as well, as Bill Moyers. And Bill Moyers has been a tireless worker over the years. I hope to have later a chance to talk, and we're going to talk about Barack Obama's speech. I've got pro and con about Barack Obama's speech. Some people thought it was great. I did. Many people thought it was not enough, too little, too late. I've heard all sorts of comments. I spent a couple of days when I wasn't doing the show at the Take Back America conference talking and interviewing people about the issues of the day, what's important to them as liberals and progressives. And once again, I use the word liberal. I think it was either Bill or Norman Lear that said that we can't get caught dead in these days calling ourselves liberal. By God, that is not my feeling. And I told everybody at my table that didn't know me, there were a couple, that I am a liberal Democrat. Okay, and you all know that. That's what I talk about. But, you know, there were parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles and brothers and cousins and everybody at this conference. And it was interesting to talk to them about their feelings. There were people from the far left. There were people there from the center. All sorts of people. And it was great to just walk up to somebody or have them walk up to me because, you know, we all wore our name badges. They knew we were on media, on Radio Row. And ask their opinions. And there were polls being taken. And I'll talk about the results of some of the polls that were taken. But I had somebody ask me a strange question. Well, what are you going to do? What are you going to do if Obama or Hillary wins the election? Then what? And we have a Democratic majority and the House and the Senate. Then what will you do? Well, the answer to that is very easy. I think they thought they had me stumped on that, but the answer to that question is very easy. It's the only answer that I think there can be to that question. I'll be doing the exact same thing that I have been doing for the last 5 years, and that is talking on this program about the issues that I think matter to America, about issues that I'm passionate about, because once this election is over, and once we take the White House, and once we get a bigger majority in the House and in the Senate, our work will be far, far from being done. We will have just gotten started on the road that we need to travel down. We have to have a bigger majority. We have to have a veto-proof majority. We have to have a better Supreme Court than we have now. We have to ensure that the Supreme Court does not fall into the hands of the neocons. We have a lot of work to do. Even if we win this election, we have got massive amounts of work to do. We have to make sure that Democrats are in the House and in the Senate who have not followed the wishes of their constituency that put them in office. We have to hold their feet to the fire and let them know that just as easily as we put them in office, we can take them out and replace them with somebody who will do what it is we want done as American citizens. So when this election is over, you don't have to worry about what this program will be about. It'll continue to be about what it has been about for 5 years, and that's bringing about what we need in this country for all of us. Not for a few people, not for the handful of people that own Wall Street, not for the handfuls of people that own the corporations and run the corporations in this country. We will be looking to do what needs to be done for all of us. That is what the Constitution of the United States is about. That is what the Founding Fathers meant when they wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and that is all that matters in this country, that it is done for all of us. So, that was an easy question for me to answer. I feel very passionately about it. I feel very passionately, as I mentioned, that the neocons believe they own us. I believe very passionately that small street in Washington, D.C., K Street, one small street, a few handfuls of people, has more political power than all of us. They believe that because they have bought their power with their money that they've made on Wall Street and they've made with their corporations. We have to take back America. We have to take it back. We're going to pause for the news a little bit early today, and we'll be back in a moment or two.
National News Net.
On the fifth anniversary of the U.S. invasion, 32 Iraqis were killed and 45 wounded. Two American soldiers were also killed. Baghdad is reported to be drowning in sewage, desperate for water and plunged in darkness for lack of electricity. British teachers warned Thursday that schools are becoming Orwellian societies where classroom video cameras monitor student behavior and staff performance. The 160,000-strong Association of Teachers and Lecturers fears Big Brother systems are putting teachers' ability to work independently at risk. President Omar Hassan al-Bashir of Sudan and President Idriss Deby of Chad signed a peace agreement meant to end cross-border rebel attacks. Chadian rebels have used the Darfur frontier as a base for launching incursions into Chad. Sudan has accused Chad of backing Darfur rebels. Global trade slowed almost to a standstill over the new year, threatening to shrink for the first time since the U.S. recession in 2001. An indicator produced by the Bureau for Economic Policy Analysis, a Dutch research institute, showed that in the 3 months leading up to January, world trade in goods rose at an annualized rate of 0.2% over the previous 3 months, a drop of 6.9%. The Institute said, this is a substantial deceleration. World trade volume growth is on a downward trend. The data is further evidence that global economic activity is slowing as growth in emerging markets has failed to compensate for weaker demand in the U.S. The last time annual growth in trade went negative was in 2001, when the shallow U.S. recession that followed the bursting of the dot-com bubble and the shock of 9/11 caused global commerce to contract. A House committee is investigating accidental electrocutions of U.S. troops in Iraq to determine if inadequate oversight of government contracts played a role in the deaths. Congressman Henry Waxman, chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, asked the Pentagon on Wednesday to provide details on 12 deaths in Iraq since 2003, believed to have been caused by electrocution. The committee is interested in maintenance contracts for troops' living areas to see if contractors have been slow to make repairs when electrical problems have been reported. The investigation was prompted by the accidental death of Army Staff Sergeant Ryan Masseth, who had a heart attack after being electrocuted while taking a shower in Iraq.
This is the Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Hey, welcome back to the Guy James Show. So good to have you along today. Back from Washington, D.C., feeling, maybe having my batteries recharged. We talk about politics every day, and some of it gets a bit old, and it's good to go and talk to lots of like-minded people and share ideas and share thoughts and share our concerns. And it was a great time. And thanks for everybody for listening. We had a nice audience for that both days. And again, to all of you who stopped by, all of you Horn fans, Mark Levine and I both enjoyed talking to you. Met many folks, lots of folks from the Democratic Underground and the DFA organization and all that. It was just great talking to everybody. I want to get into the Obama situation a little later. I will do that as soon as I can. It's a question. What do you say about it? He gave a great speech. There's no question about it. It was one of the finest political speeches, I think, that I have ever heard. Is that problem over for him yet of Reverend Wright? Probably not. Do I question whether or not Barack Obama didn't hear any of this in 20 years of going to the church? Yes, I do question that. I think anybody, any reasonable person would question whether or not he heard any of that or knew the sentiments of Reverend Wright and some of his extreme ideas. And we're not taking him out of context. There's lots of these things showing up now, what the man said. Reverend Wright can believe anything he wants to. But I will tell you this. During the Kennedy campaign when John Kennedy ran for president, my father, my brother, my mother, and I were sitting in church on Sunday, and once again, the preacher got up and started railing against John Kennedy because he was a Catholic. My father did the right thing, stood up in the middle of the sermon, pointed at my brother and my mother and I and said, "Get up, we're leaving this church." And we walked out, and he let the minister know in no uncertain terms that he did not agree with his opinions and he wouldn't sit in the pew and listen to that. That was the proper response. Maybe it wasn't politically or polite, but that was the proper response, and it's probably what the response of Barack Obama would have been. I cannot see how he could possibly have not known about the views of the Reverend. But that's his business. I think the speech was fantastic. Barack Obama right now can write and deliver a speech like that. I hope it got him out from under this. I sincerely do. I hope that's not used to crucify him in this election. It would not be fair to Barack Obama. It would not be fair. Anyway, we'll talk about that some more a little bit later on. Wanted to let you hear what Norman Lear had to say at the gala. Another very, very fine talk, and a great progressive liberal Democrat, Norman Lear.
This commitment to freedom is inscribed in our nation's founding documents.
Junior Bush is
first
talking.
First of those documents, the Declaration of Independence.
Because Norman Lear bought this document
right
he's talking
Utah,
about and put it on
the state
display.
And will be available for viewing throughout the games. The declaration is here thanks to a program created by Norman Lear. Norman, I don't always agree on politics, but we agree that the Declaration of Independence is fundamental to our nation. And I want to thank Norman Lear for his vision of providing this document for not only the people of the world to see, but for our fellow Americans to review when they come to these great games. I hope people do come and read the document because they'll understand why we're so insistent upon defending our values.
Thank you all so much. I sat here listening to these amazing people, to Van Jones with Maja Carter, and to that glorious introduction, and to the Honorable Jan Schakowsky, presented by William McNary, and then my friend Bill. And I listened to all those words, and I thought, and those performances, those speeches, the heartfelt renditions of them, and I thought, my greatest hero, I don't know who he was or she, but somewhere in history, somebody said, "I wouldn't give that spot to a leopard." Following these people. I thank you, Bill. I thank you for being here, for that wonderful introduction. I thank you and Judith for your friendship, our friendship with Lynn. And I thank everything you do for all of us. I don't know of a more significant contribution to our culture and to our political and social life than Bill Moyer's journal. Friday nights on PBS. And thank you, Bob Borisage and Roger Hickey and all of the caring people I always wanted to be like when I grew up. I am honored to be with you. If only my mother, somebody mentioned their mother earlier, if only my mother had been here to hear all these speeches and this introduction and my moment in this evening. Nothing as great as this evening could happen to me ever without my immediately thinking of my mother. To the extent that I'd hope to retain some humility and not get carried away by all of this, I always think of her. I called her a number of years ago to tell her, it was a Sunday morning, I called her to tell her that I had just gotten a phone call and learned something that was to be a secret for a little bit, that the Television Academy was going to start a Television Hall of Fame. And Mom, I had to say to her, guess who the first inductees are going to be? They're going to be David Sarnoff, who invented NBC, and William Paley, CBS, and Edward R. Murrow, one of the brilliant writers of all time, Pat Achaevsky, Lucille Ball, Milton Berle, and me. And my mother said, listen, if that's what they want to do, who am I to say? Your flyer for Take Back America Conference listed five themes for the 2008 conference: economic strategy, green jobs, healthcare, Iraq, and a new social justice agenda. These things are described as at the heart of the progressive agenda, and each is urgent, but I'd like to suggest a sixth. Can we progressives, who won't be caught dead these days calling ourselves liberals, can we stop serving as a punching bag for the right? And speak with depth and conviction about the things that really matter to us. Once and for all, can we break through the false and humiliating charade that they alone are the arbiters of family values, morality, patriotism, the flag, the life of the spirit, God talk, and that they alone have the credibility to speak to these subjects and concerns? Gotta hand it to them. 60 years or so ago, they became alarmed at us. We were the New Dealers. We were the advocates of the Great Society. And our social and political reforms were wreaking havoc on their idea of America. They're losing the country they envision to the likes of us, with our left-wing, labor-loving, business-regulating, bleeding-heart programs and policies. And finally, a relatively narrow band of wealthy far-right zealots resolved to put an end to it. Along the way, they made an interesting discovery. They found that the interests of the political neoconservatives and religious fundamentalists, the Christian right, could be joined together to serve the interests of corporate America, as Bill was talking about, which soon morphed into the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower cautioned us about. The neocons, theocons, and big business in bed together, a threesome to end all threesomes. But they were angry, they were fervent, they had big money, and they were determined to save America's soul, or at least gain power for themselves by taking America back from the progressives to the America they wanted. These were the three horses that Ronald Reagan, the great communicator, rode in on. And I submit, with Karl Rove picking up the reins, they were also the lead horses that those cowboys, George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, rode in on. Shortly thereafter, as if to certify that connection, George Bush famously declared, "I believe that God wanted me to be president." In 1979, concerned with the beginning of what became the religious right and the moral majority, now focused on the family and other groups, I watched with growing concern the proliferation of TV evangelical ministries mixing politics and religion so recklessly. And I produced a 60-second public service announcement, a kind of a video op-ed. It featured a blue-collar worker sitting on a piece of factory equipment and telling us that since his wife and he disagreed about things politically all the time, and his kids too, and they were all good Christians, there had to be something wrong when TV preachers came along saying that you were a good Christian or a bad Christian depending on your political point of view. That's not the American way, he concluded. A station or two here in D.C. played it on the evening news, among others, and NBC, among others, picked it up. Tom Brokaw, this will tell you how times have changed. Tom Brokaw devoted 7 minutes to the ad and a conversation with me. And like an act of spontaneous combustion, People for the American A was born. Now in its 26th year, People for the American Way is headed by our terrific new president, Catherine Colbert. It is a rare moment or a rare morning that I don't wake up, read my newspaper, and thank God that People for the American Way is there. People for, in its early years, called on the fairness doctrine to demand equal time of TV stations when only one side of a political question was presented. Forced to surrender the time, the stations then pressured the TV ministries to stop the practice of talking politics in a religious context. The preachers, of course, were pissed, though they would never describe it that way. I have a letter from Pat Robertson telling me that my arms were too short to box with God and that God would take his side in any fight with me. Jerry Falwell called me the biggest enemy of the American family in our generation, which it troubles me to recall brought me serious death threats. I used the word God a moment ago, and I intend to use it often tomorrow in my plenary speech. Although I think the very personal elements of our religion are private matters, the search for meaning that defines us as humans is the greatest conversation going, and I want in. Religion, as the sociologist Robert Bella has written, has played a crucial role in the development of American institutions, and there is a religious dimension to the whole fabric of American life, including the political sphere. It is the best, as I said, the best conversation going, and I want in. I also want to talk about patriotism. I love my country. I consider myself a patriot. And I do that. That's fine. Thank you. I think that of all of you. And I do that despite the fact that I don't wear a flag lapel pin, and I'm often in disagreement with the policies of my government, including my Democratic representatives in the Congress. The title of my talk here tonight, and why tomorrow is important to me, is why I am a born-again American. I chose that title because I am talking about God and country. I chose it, too, because in the context of preparing these remarks, I felt deeply the need to be a born-again American. I realized also that this was not my first born-again American experience. In 1981, when People for the American Way was in its first year, I was watching a TV preacher and heard something that all but made my heart stop. I believe it was Jimmy Swaggart urging his audience to pray for the removal, in quotes, of a Supreme Court justice whom he found particularly offensive. Removal of a lifetime appointee, a Supreme Court justice? if I live to be 1,000, and I aspire to that. I could not find the words to describe how this disturbed every fiber of my American being. A few days later, our company was having an executive retreat in San Diego. I walked into a room with a dozen or so senior executives. We had about 7 shows on the air, a few of them in the top 10 at that time. And I can still see the faces of those partners and associates I loved so much and to whom I owed so much as they waited in anticipation. And I related what I had seen and that had alarmed me so. And I said I needed to step down as president of production or whatever my title was at the time. I was going to devote myself full time to touring the country, raising awareness and financial support for people for the American way to fight this spewing of religious hatred and the serious assault on our most basic American values. I reflect on my reaction to that moment, and born again as an American is the best way I have found to describe it. And then I wonder if I'm taking myself too seriously. But it occurred to me that I can't be, because I have seen so much of that in so many, and so many of you here, so much of that reflexive need to do what you have to do because this country requires it of you, because you feel it. And in a sense, if you feel that, you can be born again an American every day you wake up to look at it as your America, to work for your America. But anyway, it was something I had to do, and something I could afford to do. Something I could afford to do. And that brings me to the subject of gratitude, with which I'd like to close these remarks. I was walking once through the woods in Vermont many years ago with a great friend and noted religious historian. We were talking about things spiritual, as we are now. And I found myself asking him, what was the shortest definition he could give me of worship? One word, he said. Gratitude. And so, I want to close tonight with the deepest of gratitude for the award you presented to me tonight, for the pride and privilege to have Bill Moyers present it to me. Gratitude for the beloved members of my family that could be here tonight and for those who couldn't. Gratitude for all the things, for all the bounty, for all the goodness in this world for which none of we extraordinary, accomplished, talented people in this room are responsible. That we are alive at this moment, born when we were and with the instincts and interests that draw us together tonight, sitting here in this state of grace, blessed with so much that none of us can take credit for. And so we address this expression of gratitude to God, to the Creator, to the Almighty, to the universe, to the fates, to great good fortune, to whatever word or image fills each of our heads when we say thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You cannot imagine how I have to pee.
Ah, Norman. Norman knew just how to end that up. He ended on a very serious note, and knew how to attach a little moment of levity at the end to bring everybody back up again. A wonderful talk by a fabulous man, well spoken. He has done so much, so much for the liberal progressive movement over the years. He poured time and money and thought into it, and he has been a real bastion of liberal progressive values over the years. And values, yes, I use the word values. We'll talk about conservative family values coming up on the next show. I have a lot to say about that. Right now, one of the big controversies going on in the country is whether or not Barack Obama extricated himself from a problem that really I don't think he's responsible for getting into. But as you know, the right is going to use it on him, maybe even some people on the left. And I know many, many, many people didn't hear only but a few excerpts of Barack Obama's speech. And so in the spirit of what we've been doing today is presenting words of wisdom to you, I want to play Barack Obama's speech for you in its entirety, so that you can soak this in and understand what a fine piece of work this was, what a well-thought speech this was, some words that America needed to hear, whether you agree with Barack or not politically. These are words America needs to hear and needs to take to heart. Ladies and gentlemen, Barack Obama.
Let me begin by thanking Harris Wofford for his contributions to this country in so many different ways. He exemplifies what we mean by the word citizen. And so we are very grateful to him for all the work he has done, and I'm thankful for the gracious and thoughtful introduction. We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, 221 years ago, in a hall that still stands across the street, a group of men gathered and with these simple words launched America's improbable experiment in democracy. Farmers and scholars, statesmen and patriots who had traveled across the ocean to escape tyranny and persecution, finally made real their Declaration of Independence at a Philadelphia convention that lasted through the spring of 1787. The document they produced was eventually signed, but ultimately unfinished. It was stained by this nation's original sin of slavery, a question that divided the colonies and brought the convention to a stalemate until the founders chose to allow the slave trade to continue for at least 20 more years and to leave any final resolution to future generations. Of course, the answer to the slavery question was already embedded within our Constitution, a Constitution that had at its very core the ideal of equal citizenship under the law, a Constitution that promised its people liberty and justice and a union that could be and should be perfected over time. And yet words on a parchment would not be enough to deliver slaves from bondage or provide men and women of every color and creed their full rights and obligations as citizens of the United States. That what would be needed were Americans in successive generations who were willing to do their part through protests and struggles on the streets and in the courts, through a civil war and civil disobedience, and always at great risk, to narrow that gap between the promise of our ideals and the reality of their time. This was one of the tasks we set forth at the beginning of this presidential campaign, to continue the long march of those who came before us, a march for a more just, more equal, more free, more caring, and more prosperous America. I chose to run for president at this moment in history because I believe deeply that we cannot solve the challenges of our time unless we solve them together, unless we perfect our union by understanding that we may have different stories, but we hold common hopes, that we may not look the same and may not have come from the same place, but we all want to move in the same direction towards a better future for our children and our grandchildren. And this belief comes from my unyielding faith in the decency and generosity of the American people. But it also comes from my own story. I'm the son of a black man from Kenya and a white woman from Kansas. I was raised with the help of a white grandfather who survived a depression to serve in Patton's army during World War II, and a wild white grandmother who worked on a bomber assembly line at Fort Leavenworth while he was overseas. I've gone to some of the best schools in America, and I've lived in one of the world's poorest nations. I am married to a black American who carries within her the blood of slaves and slave owners, an inheritance we pass on to our two precious daughters. I have brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, uncles, and cousins of every race and every hue scattered across three continents, and for as long as I live, I will never forget that in no other country on earth is my story even possible. It's a story that hasn't made me the most conventional of candidates, but it is a story that has seared into my genetic makeup the idea that this nation is more than the sum of its parts, that out of many, we are truly one. Now, throughout the first year of this campaign, against all predictions to the contrary, we saw how hungry the American people were for this message of unity. Despite the temptation to view my candidacy through a purely racial lens, we won commanding victories in states with some of the whitest populations in the country. In South Carolina, where the Confederate flag still flies, we built a powerful coalition of African Americans and white Americans. This is not to say that race has not been an issue in this campaign. At various stages in the campaign, some commentators have deemed me either too black or not black enough. We saw racial tensions bubble to the surface during the week before the South Carolina primary. The press has scoured every single exit poll for the latest evidence of racial polarization, not just in terms of white and black, but black and brown as well. And yet, it's only been in the last couple of weeks that the discussion of race in this campaign has taken a particularly divisive turn. On one end of the spectrum, we've heard the implication that my candidacy is somehow an exercise in affirmative action that is based solely on the desire of wild and wide-eyed liberals to purchase racial reconciliation on the cheap. On the other end, we've heard my former pastor, Jeremiah Wright, use incendiary language to express views that have the potential not only to widen the racial divide, but views that denigrate both the greatness and the goodness of our nation, and that rightly offend white and black alike. I have already condemned in unequivocal terms the statements of Reverend Wright that have caused such controversy and in some cases pain. For some, nagging questions remain. Did I know him to be an occasionally fierce critic of American domestic and foreign policy? Of course. Did I ever hear him make remarks that could be considered controversial while I sat in the church? Yes. Did I strongly disagree with many of his political views? Absolutely. Just as I'm sure many of you have heard remarks from your pastors, priests, or rabbis with which you strongly disagree. But the remarks that have caused this recent firestorm weren't simply controversial. They weren't simply a religious leader's efforts to speak out against perceived injustice. Instead, they expressed a profoundly distorted view of this country, a view that sees white racism as endemic and that elevates what is wrong with America above all that we know is right with America. A view that sees the conflicts in the Middle East as rooted primarily in the actions of stalwart allies like Israel, instead of emanating from the perverse and hateful ideologies of radical Islam. As such, Reverend Wright's comments were not only wrong, but divisive. Divisive at a time when we need unity, racially charged at a time when we need to come together to solve a set of monumental problems. Two wars, a terrorist threat, a falling economy, a chronic health care crisis and potentially devastating climate change. Problems that are neither black or white or Latino or Asian, but rather problems that confront us all. Given my background, my politics, and my professed values and ideals, there will no doubt be those for whom my statements of condemnation are not enough. Why associate myself with Reverend Wright in the first place, they may ask? Why not join another church? And I confess that if all that I knew of Reverend Wright were the snippets of those sermons that have run in an endless loop on the television sets and YouTube, if Trinity United Church of Christ conformed to the caricatures being peddled by some commentators, there is no doubt that I would react in much the same way. But the truth is, that isn't all that I know of the man. The man I met more than 20 years ago is a man who helped introduce me to my Christian faith, a man who spoke to me about our obligations to love one another, to care for the sick, and lift up the poor. He is a man who served his country as a United States Marine and who has studied and lectured at some of the finest universities and seminaries in the country, and who over 30 years has led a church that serves the community by doing God's work here on earth, by housing the homeless, ministering to the needy, providing daycare services and scholarships and prison ministries, and reaching out to those suffering from HIV/AIDS. In my first book, Dreams from My Father, I describe the experience of my first service at Trinity. It goes as follows. People began to shout, to rise from their seats and clap and cry out, a forceful wind carrying the Reverend's voice up to the rafters. And in that single note, hope, I heard something else. At the foot of that cross, inside the thousands of churches across the city, I imagine the stories of ordinary black people merging with the stories of David and Goliath, Moses and Pharaoh, the Christians in the lion's den, Ezekiel's field of dry bones. Those stories of survival and freedom and hope became our stories, my story. The blood that spilled was our blood, the tears our tears, until this black church on this bright day seemed once more a vessel carrying the story of a people into future generations and into a larger world. Our trials and triumphs became at once unique and universal, black and more than black. In chronicling our journey, the stories and songs gave us a meaning to reclaim memories that we didn't need to feel shame about, memories that all people might study and cherish and with which we could start to rebuild. That has been my experience at Trinity. Like other predominantly black churches across the country, Trinity embodies the black community in its entirety, the doctor and the welfare mom, the model student and the former gangbanger. Like other black churches, Trinity's services are full of raucous laughter and sometimes bawdy humor. They are full of dancing and clapping and screaming and shouting that may seem jarring to the untrained ear. The church contains in full the kindness and cruelty, the fierce intelligence and the shocking ignorance, the struggles and successes, the love and, yes, the bitterness and biases that make up the black experience in America. And this helps explain, perhaps, my relationship with Reverend Wright. As imperfect as he may be, he has been like family to me. He strengthened my faith, officiated my wedding, and baptized my children. Not once in my conversations with him have I heard him talk about any ethnic group in derogatory terms, or treat whites with whom he interacted with anything but courtesy and respect. He contains within him the contradictions, the good and the bad, of the community that he has served diligently for so many years. I can no more disown him than I can disown the black community. I can no more disown him than I can disown my white grandmother, a woman who helped raise me, a woman who sacrificed again and again for me, a woman who loves me as much as she loves anything in this world, but a woman who once confessed her fear of black men who passed her by on the street, and who on more than one occasion has uttered racial or ethnic stereotypes that made me cringe. These people are part of me, and they are part of America, this country that I love. Now, some will see this as an attempt to justify or excuse comments that are simply inexcusable. I can assure you it is not. And I suppose the politically safe thing to do would be to move on from this episode and just hope that it fades into the woodwork. We can dismiss Reverend Wright as a crank or a demagogue, just as some have dismissed Geraldine Ferraro in the aftermath of her recent statements as harboring some deep-seated bias. But race is an issue that I believe this nation cannot afford to ignore right now. We would be making the same mistake that Reverend Wright made in his offending sermons about America, to simplify and stereotype and amplify the negative to the point that it distorts reality. The fact is that the comments that have been made and the issues that have surfaced over the last few weeks reflect the complexities of race in this country that we've never really worked through, a part of our union that we have not yet made perfect. And if we walk away now, if we simply retreat into our respective corners, we will never be able to come together and solve challenges like health care or education or the need to find good jobs for every American. Understanding this reality requires a reminder of how we arrived at this point. As William Faulkner once wrote, the past isn't dead and buried. In fact, it isn't even past. We do not need to recite here the history of racial injustice in this country. But we do need to remind ourselves that so many of the disparities that exist between the African-American community and the larger American community today can be traced directly to inequalities passed on from an earlier generation that suffered under the brutal legacy of slavery and Jim Crow. Segregated schools were and are inferior schools. We still haven't fixed them 50 years after Brown versus Board of Education. And the inferior education they provided, then and now, helps explain the pervasive achievement gap between today's black and white students. Legalized discrimination, where blacks were prevented, often through violence, from owning property, or loans were not granted to African-American business owners, or black homeowners could not access FHA mortgages, or blacks were excluded from unions, or the police force, or the fire department, meant that black families could not amass any meaningful wealth to bequeath to future generations. That history helps explain the wealth and income gap between blacks and whites and the concentrated pockets of poverty that persist in so many of today's urban and rural communities. A lack of economic opportunity among black men and the shame and frustration that came from not being able to provide for one's family contributed to the erosion of black families, a problem that welfare policies for many years may have worsened, and the lack of basic services in so many urban black neighborhoods, parks for kids to play in, police walking the beat, regular garbage pickup, building code enforcement, all helped create a cycle of violence, blight, and neglect that continues to haunt us. This is the reality in which Reverend Wright and other African Americans of his generation grew up. They came of age in the late 50s and early 60s, a time when segregation was still the law of the land and opportunity was systematically constricted. What's remarkable is not how many failed in the face of discrimination, but how many men and women overcame the odds, how many were able to make a way out of no way for those like me who would come after them. But for all those who scratched and clawed their way to get a piece of the American dream, there were many who didn't make it. Those who were ultimately defeated in one way or another by discrimination. That legacy of defeat was passed on to future generations. Those young men and increasingly young women who we see standing on street corners or languishing in our prisons without hope or prospects for the future. Even for those blacks who did make it, questions of race and racism continue to define their worldview in fundamental ways. For the men and women of Reverend Wright's generation, the memories of humiliation and doubt and fear have not gone away, nor is the anger and the bitterness of those years. That anger may not get expressed in public, in front of white co-workers or white friends, but it does find voice in the barbershop or the beauty shop or around the kitchen table. At times, that anger is exploited by politicians to gin up votes along racial lines or to make up for a politician's own failings. And occasionally, it finds voice in the church on Sunday morning, in the pulpit, and in the pews. The fact that so many people are surprised to hear that anger in some of Reverend Wright's sermons simply reminds us of the old truism that the most segregated hour of American life occurs on Sunday morning. That anger is not always productive. Indeed, all too often, it distracts attention from solving real problems. It keeps us from squarely facing our own complicity within the African-American community in our own condition. It prevents the African-American community from forging the alliances it needs to bring about real change. But the anger is real. It is powerful. And to simply wish it away, to condemn it without understanding its roots, only serves to widen the chasm of misunderstanding that exists between the races. In fact, a similar anger exists within segments of the white community. Most working and middle-class white Americans don't feel that they've been particularly privileged by their race. Their experience is the immigrant experience. As far as they're concerned, no one handed them anything. They built it from scratch. They've worked hard all their lives, many times only to see their jobs shipped overseas or their pensions dumped after a lifetime of labor. They are anxious about their futures, and they feel their dreams slipping away. And in an era of stagnant wages and global competition, opportunity comes to be seen as a zero-sum game in which your dreams come at my expense. So when they are told to bus their children to a school across town, when they hear an African-American is getting an advantage in landing a good job or a spot in a good college because of an injustice that they themselves never committed, when they're told that their fears about crime in urban neighborhoods are somehow prejudice, resentment builds over time. Like the anger within the black community, these resentments aren't always expressed in polite company, but they have helped shape the political landscape for at least a generation. Anger over welfare and affirmative action helped forge the Reagan coalition. Politicians routinely exploited fears of crime for their own electoral ends. Talk show hosts and conservative commentators built entire careers unmasking bogus claims of racism while dismissing legitimate discussions of racial injustice and inequality as mere political correctness or reverse racism. And just as black anger often proved counterproductive, so have these white resentments distracted attention from the real culprits of the middle class squeeze. A corporate culture rife with inside dealing, questionable accounting practices, and short-term greed. A Washington dominated by lobbyists and special interests. Economic policies that favor the few over the many. And yet to wish away the resentments of white Americans, to label them as misguided or even racist, without recognizing they are grounded in legitimate concerns, this too widens the racial divide and blocks the path to understanding. This is where we are right now. It's a racial stalemate we've been stuck in for years. And contrary to the claims of some of my critics, black and white, I have never been so naive as to believe that we can get beyond our racial divisions in a single election cycle or with a single candidate, particularly a candidacy as imperfect as my own. But I have asserted a firm conviction, a conviction rooted in my faith in God and my faith in the American people, that working together, we can move beyond some of our old racial wounds, and that, in fact, we have no choice. We have no choice if we are to continue on the path of a more perfect union. For the African-American community, that path means embracing the burdens of our past without becoming victims of our past. It means continuing to insist on a full measure of justice in every aspect of American life. But it also means binding our particular grievances for better health care and better schools and better jobs to the larger aspirations of all Americans. The white woman struggling to break the glass ceiling. The white man who's been laid off. The immigrant trying to feed his family. And it means also taking full responsibility for our own lives by demanding more from our fathers and spending more time with our children and reading to them and teaching them that while they may face challenges and discrimination in their own lives, they must never succumb to despair or cynicism. They must always believe that they can write their own destiny. Ironically, this quintessentially American and, yes, conservative notion of self-help found frequent expression in Reverend Wright's sermons. But what my former pastor too often failed to understand is that embarking on a program of self-help also requires a belief that society can change. The profound mistake of Reverend Wright's sermons is not that he spoke about racism in our society. It's that he spoke as if our society was static, as if no progress had been made, as if this country, a country that has made it possible for one of his own members to run for the highest office in the land and build a coalition of white and black, Latino, Asian, rich, poor, young, and old, is still irrevocably bound to a tragic past. What we know, what we have seen, is that America can change. That is the true genius of this nation. What we have already achieved gives us hope, the audacity to hope, for what we can and must achieve tomorrow. Now, in the white community, the path to a more perfect union means acknowledging that what ails the African-American community does not just exist in the minds of black people, that the legacy of discrimination and current incidents of discrimination, while less overt than in the past, that these things are real and must be addressed, not just with words, but with deeds, by investing in our schools, in our communities, by enforcing our civil rights laws and ensuring fairness in our criminal justice system, by providing this generation with ladders of opportunity that were unavailable for previous generations. It requires all Americans to realize that your dreams do not have to come at the expense of my dreams. That investing in the health, welfare, and education of black and brown and white children will ultimately help all of America prosper. In the end, then, what is called for is nothing more and nothing less than what all the world's great religions demand, that we do unto others as we would have them do unto us. Let us be our brother's keeper, Scripture tells us. Let us be our sister's keeper. Let us find that common stake we all have in one another, and let our politics reflect that spirit as well. For we have a choice in this country. We can accept a politics that breeds division and conflict and cynicism. We can tackle race only as spectacle, as we did in the OJ trial, or in the wake of tragedy, as we did in the aftermath of Katrina, or as fodder for the nightly news. We can play Reverend Wright's sermons on every channel every day and talk about them from now until the election, and make the only question in this campaign whether or not the American people think that I somehow believe or sympathize with his most offensive words. We can pounce on some gaffe by a Hillary supporter as evidence that she's playing the race card, or we can speculate on whether white men will all flock to John McCain in the general election, regardless of his policies. We can do that. But if we do, I can tell you that in the next election, we'll be talking about some other distraction, and then another one, and then another one, and nothing will change. That is one option. Or, at this moment, in this election, we can come together and say, not this time. This time we want to talk about the crumbling schools that are stealing the future of black children and white children and Asian children and Hispanic children and Native American children. This time we want to reject the cynicism that tells us that these kids can't learn, that those kids who don't look like us are somebody else's problem. The children of America are not those kids. They are our kids, and we will not let them fall behind in the 21st century economy. Not this time. This time we want to talk about how the lines in the emergency room are filled with whites and blacks and Hispanics who do not have health care, who don't have the power on their own to overcome the special interests in Washington, but who can take them on if we do it together. This time, we want to talk about the shuttered mills that once provided a decent life for men and women of every race, and the homes for sale that once belonged to Americans from every religion, every region, every walk of life. This time, we want to talk about the fact that the real problem is not that someone who doesn't look like you might take your job, it's that the corporation you work for will ship it overseas for nothing more than a profit. This time, we want to talk about the men and women of every color and creed who serve together and fight together and bleed together under the same proud flag. We want to talk about how to bring them home from a war that should have never been authorized and should have never been waged. And we want to talk about how we'll show our patriotism by caring for them and their families and giving them the benefits that they have earned. I would not be running for president if I didn't believe with all my heart that this is what the vast majority of Americans want for this country. This union may never be perfect, but generation after generation has shown that it can always be perfected. And today, whenever I find myself feeling doubtful or cynical about this possibility, what gives me the most hope is the next generation. The young people whose attitudes and beliefs and openness to change have already made history in this election. There's one story in particular that I'd like to leave you with today. A story I told when I had the great honor of speaking on Dr. King's birthday at his home church, Ebenezer Baptist, in Atlanta. There's a young 23-year-old woman, a white woman, named Ashley Bai, who organized for our campaign in Florence, South Carolina. She'd been working to organize a mostly African-American community since the beginning of this campaign. And one day she was at a roundtable discussion where everyone went around telling their story and why they were there. And Ashley said that when she was 9 years old, her mother got cancer. And because she had to miss days of work, she was let go and lost her health care. They had to file for bankruptcy. And that's when Ashley decided that she had to do something to help her mom. She knew that food was one of their most expensive costs. And so Ashley convinced her mother that what she really liked and really wanted to eat more than anything else was mustard and relish sandwiches, because that was the cheapest way to eat. That's the mind of a 9-year-old. She did this for a year until her mom got better. And so Ashley told everyone at the round table that the reason she had joined our campaign was so that she could help the millions of other children in the country who want and need to help their parents too. Now, Ashley might have made a different choice. Perhaps somebody told her along the way that the source of her mother's problems were blacks who were on welfare and too lazy to work, or Hispanics who were coming into the country illegally. But she didn't. She sought out allies in her fight against injustice. Anyway, Ashley finishes her story and then goes around the room and asks everyone else why they're supporting the campaign. They all have different stories and different reasons. Many bring up a specific issue. And finally, they come to this elderly black man who's been sitting there quietly the entire time. And Ashley asks him why he's there. And he doesn't bring up a specific issue. He does not say health care or the economy. He does not say education or the war. He does not say that he was there because of Barack Obama. He simply says to everyone in the room, I am here because of Ashley. I'm here because of Ashley. Now, by itself, that single moment of recognition between that young white girl and that old black man is not enough. It is not enough to give health care to the sick, or jobs to the jobless, or education to our children. But it is where we start. It is where our union grows stronger. And as so many generations have come to realize over the course of the 221 years since a band of patriots signed that document right here in Philadelphia, that is where perfection begins. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
Well, in what I think will go down as a classic in speeches, I have said before, and I will say again, I was most impressed with that. We'll have plenty of time to discuss that in future programs. Whether or not it helped his campaign, whether or not this whole incident will be forgotten with Reverend Wright, whether or not the racism can be put aside. Odd that we're trying to put aside racism, trying to forget that there's color involved, and yet we must be cognizant of the folks in minority community, of the problems they still have in this country. So we'll discuss that. Thanks for listening today. A little bit different show today, I know, but lots of audio I felt that you wanted or needed to hear. And from the emails we've gotten, I know you've appreciated it. Thanks for listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. Don't forget.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I'm so glad that Guy played Barack Obama's speech in full, because I think it's a speech, it's not just a matter of history, but one that really goes to the core of what it means to be American and dealing with the great problem of American history. I would argue the greatest problem of American history, the questions of race. I do think it was a speech that will go down in the history books. And if you want to hear it again, I have it on my website at radioinsidescoop.com. Right up there, you can click it maybe on the weekend when the horn's not on. If you want to see and hear it again, it's right there, a link to the video. It's definitely worthwhile seeing. I